Hi, this is Bruce Ryder, Five Finger Death Punch, and you're listening to the Jay Franzi Show.
Welcome to the Jay Franzi Show, a behind-the-curtain look at the entertainment industry with insights you can't pay for and stories you've never heard. Now, here's your host, Jay Franzi.
Well, thank you for joining me and welcome to the show. I am Jay Franzi, and if you are new here, this is where we take a deep dive into the entertainment industry to provide you with valuable insights and entertaining stories. This week, we get to talk with a live sound engineer. We'll talk with Joe Kaiser. We'll talk to him about his time on the road, what his current role with Nickelback is like, and we'll take a deep dive into his time with ZZ Top. Now, tonight's episode is going to be a little bit different because joining Joe will be his longtime mentor, Tony Cottrell. Tony is also a live sound engineer and an educator. Both Joe and Tony have an amazing career in live sound, and I can't wait to talk with them tonight. So if you would like to join in, comment, or fire off any questions, please head over to jfranzi.com. Now let's get started. It is so good to have you guys here tonight. I am so excited. Let's just jump right in. Joe, sir, can you tell us how you get your start working with Nickelback?
They were desperate. No. you know, really, I pursued this one. I knew their old guy, still know their old guy. And I had gotten called to fill in on a couple of dates that I couldn't do. And I'd said, hey, I said, if it ever comes up again, I would really like to do this. Because I always felt like, but he was a friend of mine. I didn't want to weasel in on his gig. But I did say, if you ever leave, I really feel like I could mix this band. I grew up in the 80s. So Nickelback's heavy. And they're pop. Yeah. I grew up listening to heavy and I grew up listening to pop. Anyway, so I thought that's the perfect thing for me because I like big, heavy rock shows. I know I can mix this band. Anyway, I did end up going and subbing in at one point. And that's how I got to meet the guys and we all hit it off well. Everything worked out well. And it has a lot of fun. I thought, well, it's the end of that. Well, they took a big old long break. Orris went and did Steven Tyler.
A little bit of an overlap.
Nickelback gets ready to go back. Yeah, and Nickelback is straight back on the road. He goes, man, I love Aerosmith. I got to go do this. So he is like, hey, you remember Joe? So anyway, I got a call from the production manager. And he said, hey, you know, your name's come up. And the guys want to see a resume and talk it over. And so I did that whole game. And I kind of figured that's into that. I mean, a week or two goes by and I hear nothing. And then this guy, this production manager, Jesse, calls me. He goes, hey, man. He says, hey, okay, the guys say you're in. It's you. I go, well, what do you mean? I mean, we don't go anywhere and do anything. It's like, it was just too easy, right?
Right.
But was funny, my first gig with them was in Edmonton at a stadium, which I just did it recently again. And it was for a benefit. And we went to LA and it was the band's first gig in a year or so. And this was 2015, I think. We go to LA to rehearse. You know, I'm on edge a little bit. Nobody knows me. I mean, I'd met him before, but you know what I'm saying? I'm an unknown. And so we go to wherever they're in Burbank and we're rehearsing for a couple of days. Well, the guys don't show up for, I don't know. They come in. I told the band's coming in one day and they come in pretty late. When they did show up, they kind of just jammed a bunch of cover songs. And we're getting ready to go to the stadium. I thought we'd work through the set, right? Mm-hmm. I guess they figured they know their songs. I don't know. They just jammed all these Metallica and Pantera songs. I'm with the zeroed console trying to get something together here, you know, and they're like, all right, let's go eat dinner. If I remember right, they were supposed to come back in and rehearse the next day. Well, they didn't. They decided, screw it, we're not coming back. So I'm like, oh my God, man, I'm going to go mix this band. The next day we're flying to Edmonton. I'm going to go do this band at the stadium. I got half of a kind of rehearsal of cover tunes. Well, it's been nice knowing you. I told the system, I told the tech, his name is Jim Riggs. I told Jim that day, I go, everybody's really nice. It was nice getting to know everybody, but this isn't going to work out, obviously, man. I mean, this is a stadium, and this is going to suck.
Yeah.
They came out, and they started playing, and it was like, oh, it doesn't suck. Maybe I'll get through. And it was so funny because what they did goofing off in rehearsal was one thing, but, man, when they came out and started playing, it was like, whoa, this is a freight train coming at you, and it was fun. And anyway, I got through it, and that's how I started mixing Nickelback.
That's awesome. What's your favorite thing about working with them?
You know, doing the shows. It's just the fun bit. It's a cliche. I'm just repeating myself, but just mixing. I enjoy the music. There's never a time. I've done a lot of tours with these guys now. I've been around the world with them a few times, everywhere from Moscow to Tokyo and a lot of places in between. And I never get bored. Once the show kicks off, I mean, certainly, you know, there's days where it's like, man, this tour started in June and it just ended in October 6th. I think I came home twice in that time.
He was a little burnt out.
I was. By the time I saw you, I was a little burned, you know. But that being said, I never sit there and go, oh, my God, I just can't stand being out here. I never have that day with those guys. Or when I see the guys, I don't avoid them. They're not one of those bands where you're going, oh, my God, I don't want to talk to Chad. I don't want to talk. It's just the opposite. When you see them, they're like, hey. And they're usually talking about life, man. How you doing? How's that knee holding up? Or, you know what I mean? Just chatting about normal stuff. Mm-hmm. So I think that is the fact that after all these years, I can live a pretty darn straightforward, not too chaotic life on the road. And you know, that's it.
Yeah.
You guys are both from Ohio. When did you move to Nashville?
Oddly enough, man, it's like freaking destiny, you know. But I moved to Nashville in 99 and Joe moves to Nashville in 99.
And I moved to Nashville in 99. Just throwing
you
that
did.
Out.
Did you? I didn't know that.
Ain't that cool, man? It is so awesome. Both of you guys. I love you guys to death. I do. Anyway, so Joe had a very clear path of what he was going to do. That's when Brad Paisley was just starting Shelley Wright. Mm-hmm. So Joe was out with Shelley and then, you know, he just got his great reputation really quick around town. Then he folded into the Keith Urban tour.
When did you do that with Keith?
04 is when it started. So his old front of house guy was a friend of mine. And they asked me, Claire Brothers asked me to go out as the PA tech. You know?
I did monitors on a couple of his shows when I first moved to Nashville.
Oh, really? Awesome. Way back then. So before me. That was way back
then. Wedges or ears? Or
it was Wedges at the time.
Yeah, it wrote it at that point in time.
Awesome.
Yeah, Steve pulled me in to do the systems thing, and then Steve left for a while, and I filled in for him. Then I did monitors, and then that went back and forth until I finally left that thing. But I learned a lot about the road stuff during that gig, for sure. But Steve was a good mixer.
Yeah, he is a great mixer.
So far, what's been the highlight of your career?
This
is the right highlight. Now. Right now, this is the highlight of everybody's career.
Boy, that's a hard one to answer.
I've got something.
Just be thinking, Joe.
Granted. Yeah, be thinking, Joe. We just take for granted when you were out with artists and touring and things like that. It's a lot of work. Yeah. It can be a lot of work. And I was Ronnie Millsap's monitor engineer at one point in time, and he was all monitor wedges, and I think we had 22 boxes on the stage. But anyway, so we were opening up for Glenn Campbell's last tour, and I mean, it's freaking Glenn Campbell, you know what I mean? And he wasn't well at that time. You know, Glenn just wasn't doing so good, and you know, everybody knew it, and its audience knew it, and things like that. But anyway, we were doing the tour with him. We were opening up, and we were doing that amphitheater in Chicago. So as the opening act and the monitor guy, I've got to get all of Ronnie's wedges up and the band's wedges up. And you know, even though it was digital consoles, it's just a lot of work. And I was exhausted. By the time this thing was done, I got everything tore down. Glenn Campbell's getting ready to go on. And I didn't have the energy to even stand side of the stage. You know, I go back to the dressing room. I just sit down in a chair there and just licking my wounds. And man, this is freaking miserable. What a miserable day this has been. And they have the front of house mix piping through the ceiling speakers. And here is Glenn Campbell playing through the ceiling speakers like Rhinestone Cowboy or one of those songs like that. And you just stop for a minute and you go, okay.
Not so bad. Yeah.
This is pretty cool.
Right.
There is Glenn Campbell. Sounds just like the record. And so everything was okay after that.
That's awesome. All right, Joe, you're on the spot.
I don't know. I mean, I remember doing this ZZ Top thing. And you know, for me, I mean, well, you grew up at the same time. in the 80s. That was everything.
Best
right?
light show I've ever seen, by the way.
I got a story. I'll go back to that. Anyway, so when I was mixing those guys, I'm going, this is it, man. I don't know. People might kind of think, well, that's not a big deal. For me, it was. I grew up on those guys. So doing people like that, Jeff Beck or Joe Walsh gig or whatever, all those moments, I did feel like if it all ends right now, that's cool. That's good.
Best of the best.
I made it that far somehow. I don't know if I have a certain moment to really go to, but just globally, those types of moments, just sitting there going, man, this is okay. Billy, the ZZ thing, definitely. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I went to dinner with that guy, usually Waffle House, by the way. And we would just there again talk about life, man. And he would ask me, like, where'd you grow up? And we would talk about that and talk about how I grew up. He generally cared, and we'd have normal conversations. That type of stuff to me meant way more than any certain gig or audio thing that happened for a certain moment or whatever. I mean, you know, I'll think of another answer after this whole thing's over tonight, I'm sure. But that kind of doing the Jeff Beck thing was cool
just
for me.
Give me a call in the morning.
Yeah, go ahead. Sneak this in there. You know, and really, the Jeff Beck thing came about because of Billy. Jeff was opening dates for ZZ, and his guy had to go back. Dave went back to the Stones, and they're like, well, we don't have a front house guy. And Dave and Billy both like, well, Joe's standing right there, you know. So then ZZ ended, and Jeff went on for the rest of the summer. So I ended up doing the Jeff Beck thing. But anyway,
it's got to feel cool when somebody, you know, recommends you like that too.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think if there's still like a certain there's something will pop into my head. I'm sure there's probably some stories. The ones in my head right now, but I probably shouldn't tell that. You know,
those are the ones we like.
A couple of those. Yeah,
I always like the story of Billy Gibbs buying
the speakers from the custom speaker. You ever see pictures? And I saw the pictures. I've seen the pictures on the internet a few times. There's these big, the custom. I think they're made in the UK, weren't they? Is that where they came from?
Custom cabinets.
If you look at, there's a picture, a pretty well known picture of Frank Baird's drum kit, and it's got these custom. They're beautiful. It's like silver foam line or whatever around them. He bought them.
Oh, 60s style.
Yeah.
Custom speakers.
We were in, I remember this well, we were on the road and he came in the next day all thrilled and Big Genius driver. They were all laughing about it because Billy was like, he's very savvy with, you know, his iPhone and Mac and all this. And so he was living on Craigslist or something like that at the time. And he found this guy in Florida that had these custom cabinets. And he's, you know, the tour bus rolling down the road. Gibbons is on his bus cutting this deal. Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what they did. So he's like, hey, you know, will you take whatever it was, you know, $5,000 for them? I don't know what they are. And he's like, meet us at exit, you know, 34A. And this tour bus pulls over on the side of the road. Gibbons often wears like pajamas too, you know. So Gene told me he was dying laughing because this guy pulls up in a pickup truck and he's got these custom cabinets in the back on the berm.
He has no idea who's coming to pick him up or anything.
And it's like, yeah, this is where he said a guy just kept looking inside this bus, you know, and freaking Billy Gibbons climbs off this tour bus and hands the guy a bunch of cash. And they load him in the bay of the bus. But those things were on the rest of that tour. They were on. You can find tons of. That's where those came from, though. Mm-hmm. I think it's somewhere in Florida. He bought them off the side of the road.
Yeah.
He did stuff like that all the time.
God, yeah. I love that story.
Tony, I know you've had a chance to travel the world and mix in all sorts of venues. Do you have any favorites?
Well, you know,
it's hard to answer that stuff.
I know. I'm just thinking, you know, if you're a musician or you're an audio guy here in Nashville, there's probably three venues you want to mix. That's the Ryman. You want to mix Bridgestone and you want to mix Nissan Stadium, LP Field, Nissan Stadium. You know, I got to mix all three of those with three different artists. So I guess I've had an okay career. I can stop.
You can retire now.
No. So, I guess it's just something about your home field, you know, playing your home field, mixing your home field that feels like you've accomplished something.
Who'd you mix in Nissan?
Exile. I mixed Exile and Nissan, Jamie Johnson at the Ryman, and LV Shane at Bridgestone, three different artists.
Very cool.
Yeah, man.
What was it like playing the Ryman?
That's pretty cool place. You know what I mean? I mean, it's all the history in that place and it's their venue sounds great. That's before they put the new PA in it. Joe, you've mixed it a few times.
I've not been in it in a long time. I think the last time I was in it was with Jeff Beck.
Yeah. But the room sounds great.
I was doing sound over at Bridgestone for the Predators. And I had to walk across the catwalk one day and realized, you know what? I'm afraid of heights.
Yeah, I hate that. I've had riggers take me up. Yeah. The older I get, the less I cannot. I don't like heights at all, dude. I had a rigger take me up. Somebody earlier took me up in Brisbane, Australia. He goes, hey, you want to see the grid? And I stupidly said yes. I rode the elevator up with him. Lights are out because it's rehearsals. Sonny just takes off. I'm halfway. I was like a cat, man. I got as close as I could to the floor. I was petrified.
I walked like 5 feet under that catwalk and turned around and said, I'm done.
I know.
I'm good. I don't know how you guys do
I'll watch the
And if you look at the railing, it's knee high. It's like, what good is this railing going to do for me?
Yeah.
No.
I don't know why that is. The older we get, the more we fear heights.
Because we know what's going to happen when you fall.
Yeah, exactly.
I could die.
How did the collaboration over at Belmont come about?
I went to Atlanta and Joe was in Ohio, and then we both kind of converged there in Nashville. But that time I was teaching live sound at Belmont, and we would do these showcases. And the showcases, the students would be the engineers, they would be producers, lighting, artist wranglers. I mean, they would basically do everything. And Joe would come in with the Claire system, and he would teach the students how to fly the PA, and the other Claire techs would come in. But it was really exciting. I think it was exciting for the students too.
Yeah.
They still do those showcases. That was in the basketball arena. So these students who were juniors and seniors were getting to mix at a major show in an arena while they were still in school. I mean, it was just really an incredible experience. I remember when a lot of women in audio, with live audio at that time, one girl, Rachel Alves, and she was wanting to get into live audio, and she's taking my live audio classes. We had Vince Gill playing that showcase, and I had her mix Vince, and I think that gave her a massive amount of confidence as she was graduating from college. You know what I'm saying? I mean, mixing something like that in an arena, and she's a pretty successful woman in our industry right now.
I remember doing all that. It was fun to take those rigs in there.
You're showing them how to put the system together, how to fly it, the angles. You were showing the software.
You know, I spent more time doing that than I did mixing, really, because I just felt at that time that was more important. Where does power come from? How does power get implemented throughout the whole system? And what happens when it doesn't work? I mean, that's the thing.
Yeah,
it's a high pressure situation. We're on the road and things. It shuts. And that's I didn't realize any of that. You know, when something major isn't happening, those 20,000 people are still getting off of work at 4 and driving to that show. I've been to plenty of shows where doors are. I mean, I was the systems guy in 2020. Was it two with Kid Rock for that summer? My friend Russell was actually mixing. I was a systems tech. It was a lot of stuff. A lot of crap on that stage. And there was a few days where I can remember some things would be going on with the power or whatever, and it'd be 5 o'clock. You know, it's time for doors to open and things still aren't quite ready. It can be pressure. Mm-hmm. But it worked. We didn't have a show that didn't happen, but definitely some pressure.
Yeah.
Now, I know each venue comes with its own set of challenges, but what's your approach when it comes to mixing a live show?
You know, I think Joe and I both believe in is we listen like fans, but mix like engineers.
That goes back to what he said earlier. Like, what's the best thing about mixing Nickelback? That I can mix it as a fan.
Right.
Like, even if I wasn't mixing them, I would still listen to the tunes. Yeah. I mean, just face it. Anybody that hates them, you get in the car and crank up a song like Animals and tell me it doesn't want to make you drive faster, run everybody else off the road, which is kind of a cool thing.
You're there to mix for that audience.
I keep an eye on the audience. And the audience wants it pumping. But there's a fine line where it's, okay, I got to tuck this thing back a little bit.
Look around your audience.
You know what makes that stuff so fun to mix, though, too, is like live. They are that man. Could you imagine if they weren't powerful live?
No,
it would just fall apart. I mean, I wouldn't be there because those records are huge. And if they couldn't do it live, I wouldn't want to be there because I'd be that guy. I would get blamed. I want it to be so big that I love it when it starts and you can see the audience just kind of rear back, like, wow, okay. Everybody puts their seatbelt on, and for the next 2 hours, it's like, buckle up because it's,
it's about to go somewhere. How do you even capture that power?
There again, I follow what they do, but, my whole thing is, making it clean. I mean, the band like that, I spend time putting the mix together, making sure it's a good, powerful, complementary mix, meaning everything's complementing, all the instruments or inputs are complementing one another. My biggest thing I do is I make sure resonant frequencies are not getting in the way of the mix. And resonant frequencies are such a big thing in all these rooms. I walk into the room in the morning, I go, wow. I start calling out frequencies. I hear them. It's like, yep. And then the systems guy will tune a little bit. And it's like, wow, man, a lot of 200 in here today. So that's what I spend my time doing, is cleaning up what I hear in that room and letting that power happen. That power is there. I just make sure nothing gets in the way of it. And if it's clean and clear and there's no masking going on, I'll do, you know, I tell you something I do every day. It's I take all the big crunchy guitars, and I've got a big bass guitar too. It's big sounds. And to make them heard, let them be heard. I can't let them get in the way of one another. So I will take both of these crunchy guitars I have, send them to a group. No processing. It's just, I'm a big high pass filter, high and low pass filters on every channel. And I just carve unwanted extremes out, right? So what I'll do, I'll pull those guitars up from the night before. I'll pull Mike's bass up, and I'll take the high pass filter on that guitar group, take it completely down where you can hear it. It's conflicting a lot with the bass guitar. And I run that thing up a little bit. And all of a sudden the bass guitar just jumps up. I got things out of the way. Didn't make the guitars too thin. I'm getting all technical here, but I'm giving you an example of what I do in a room. And the reason I change it, why would you change that? What changed on the input? Nothing, but the room did change a little bit. So it's a combination of the EQ of the PA and what I'm doing on that channel to get that clean, powerful thing that you're talking about and clear at the same time.
Do you have any idea if they have any plans on adding Get 'Em Up to the set list?
You got to be kidding me. It's so funny. I've pushed for that too. So I don't know. I've mentioned that to Chad a couple of times. There was supposed to be another, like a B to that song. That if you watch that video, he told me one time where that song came about. If I remember right, he told me that he had the video in mind before he wrote the song. It's kind of a funny video. These goofballs rob a bank and realize they don't have enough sense to rob a bank and get them up. And anyway, I've tried to get him to do that one. And he just kind of laughs and goes, oh, that's a good one. That's a good one. We should do it sometime. But I don't know. I would like to. I would like to get him to do that one for sure. It's funny you mentioned that, because that's one of my favorites too.
That's pretty cool. Tell us about some of the challenges that you or even the band may have faced.
We did Boston this year, I think. I've done a stadium there. We did a radio show right there next to the stadium. We had to get a police escort. Jim Bump, the monitor guy, and myself, we didn't even get to the venue until 5 o'clock. Took all day. So rolled in. I mean, doors are open. It was a cool day. It was a busy day. It was a cool day. I know no matter what, Daniel's going to come out and slam. He's a beast. He's like a drum machine. And Chad's going to sing loud.
Yeah, we had Tommy Harding on the show a few weeks back, and he talked about Billy being quite a character. What's it like working with Billy Gibbons?
We were in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and we rehearsed there a lot for some reason at that Hard Rock there. You ever done that Hard Rock?
Oh, yeah.
So you park out back there, is that fenced-in area. Gibbons and I had been running around all day, and I'll never forget, there's like a Walmart 2 miles down the road. It's hot as can be, and I'm going to walk down to that Walmart, and I'm like half a mile down the road, and this freaking big old truck pulls over. And I see this big truck pulls over, and I see like this hand come out the window. There's like rings and a bracelet. It's Gibbons. I go walking up, and he had hired a driver for the day. And he's like, jump in. So I hop in with this driver and Billy, and we go running around all day. I'll never forget, man, we're driving. We go hop off the main road onto this, turns into an old dirt road. It's like something out of the movie. And man, we go back to this shack that he knew about in the woods, and these guys were like cooking up all these sausages and stuff. It was the weirdest thing in the world. They were saying it was gator meat. I'm like, where are you guys getting gator meat? Oklahoma, what? So Billy buys tons and tons of this freaking sausage from these dudes back in the woods that he knew they were back there. It was the nastiest smelling stuff I've ever smelled in my life, dude. And I'm riding in the back with all this bags of sausage and this meat. I'm like, dude, I'm freaking. And I'm riding like that. They got the window down and I'm cruising down the road. He's texting people. So we go back and we're hanging out at his bus. I remember, man, he was giving people like plates of meat for like a week, dude. Hey, you want some sausage? I'm like, no, dude, I'm out of milk, man.
That's fine.
You know? So anyway, that night, he's like, who's playing? Because we had a night off, and we rolled in town a little early. He's like, well, who's playing? I said, Fogarty, man. The marquee says Fogarty's playing. He's like, oh. He goes, you want to go? I'm like, I'll go see Fogarty. Why
maybe
not?
He wants some sausage.
Maybe he wants some sausage. Right. So I'm like, you know, certainly I'll go hang out. So we go, and on the way up to the door, he goes, do you know him? I said, Fogarty? He goes, yeah. I said, no, I don't know him. I said, you do.
We go way back.
He goes, right, exactly. What a thing to have. And I said, well, you do. And he goes, never met the man. I thought he's messing with me, right? I said, come on. There's no way you don't know John Fogarty. He goes, nope, never met him. So we get up to the back door of that place. If you remember, there's a little staircase right there. And we just literally knock on the back door of the venue. It's 5 o'clock or so. And this security person opens it. Well, this guy looks out the back door, and it was Fergus, tour manager, I think, recognizes Gibbons right away. So he comes out, you know, Mr. Gibbons, it's a pleasure to meet you, and blah, 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 blah. And come on in. So they thought I was cool just because I'm hanging out with Billy. So they have us in there. We're standing in that little, there's a little green room, dressing room right there behind stage. And I hear the call on the radio, hey, John, Billy Gibbons is here and I'd like to say hello. And so I still think that he's lying to me about it. And Fogarty comes walking down the hallway and he's like, sir, it is a pleasure. I've always wanted to meet you. And it was true. They had never met before. It's kind of fascinating. So they sat there and had this whole conversation. Man, I wish I could have hit record on this thing and just thrown it down, you know.
Yeah.
But what's cool though is Kenny Aronoff was playing drums. And I'd met Kenny before many members of the Urban and with other people. I'd worked with Kenny on a couple of TV things. And then Billy just runs off with Fogarty because I was the only person standing there with nobody to hang out with. So he's like, hey, man, come in here. So he and I hung out. Billy, it's on YouTube. He got up and sat in that night and played with Fogarty. And we hung out all night long. And then afterwards, Fogarty didn't want him to leave. It was kind of interesting watching Fogarty be like, he was hanging on to Gibbons tight. You know, he didn't want him to go anywhere. So we hung out till the wee hours, man.
Yeah, no, Kenny is awesome. How was that?
It was fun talking to Kenny. Actually, I reminded Kenny of playing in the 80s. In the 80s, John Cougar came to Chillicothe.
No kidding.
I got a petition up. He came and played a free
right.
show.
He asked me, you know, like, where are you from? And I told him, you know, I said, dude, I grew up in Ohio. And we talked about the Columbus Percussion Center. And I said, you actually came to my hometown. And he's like, dude, I remember that gig. And like, he's like a high school or something. I'm like, yeah, it's a gymnasium. But it was kind of funny talking to him about that.
Yeah. That was a big deal for Chillicothe, wasn't
it? Yeah. It was kind of interesting dealing with all of those guys that night and just being, man, I was around a couple times. I was around Gibbons too with Billy Bob Thornton.
Oh, yeah.
And I really wish I could have thrown the phone down for that one sitting at catering because they were buddies. They were really tight. So Thornton would come out and open gigs or hang out or whatever. But then there was a couple times that it was just, I'm sitting there at a table with those two and they're chatting about stuff. And it's like, man, I so badly wish I could just record this conversation and share these moments because that's never happening again. You know,
do you have any idea if Billy keeps any of those old props?
So we were rehearsing in Houston one time and the rehearsal space it's exactly like it should be. So you pull into this, you know, those you store it places. There's a bunch of them. They're popular forever. Most of them are pretty nice. This one, I think, was built in like 1978. The concrete's all cracked, and there's like all these storage facilities. That's where they rehearsed. They still rent the building. And so you go in this office-looking space. You can tell nothing's been changed since they probably rehearsed the Eliminator record there. And there's all these drum heads hanging on the wall. There's just, dude, this rehearsal space is awesome. There's just stuff. You know how people stage those record photos? That's how their space really looks. And everywhere. It's awesome. Anyway, so Jake, the monitor guy, goes, it was the first time I'd ever been there. And he said, hey, we were there really early, and then we got this text, hey, nobody's shown up till 4, and it's like noon. Jake goes, hey, man, you want to come look at where everything's stored? There's two buildings behind, and they're big buildings. And we go back there and unlock them. Dude, they've never sold anything. All the old stuff, the old set pieces, everything, things I recognized. I was just climbing over. There was D88s, all these machines. I found a Tab soda with the old peel off. It had never been opened. I videotaped all this on my phone. They had the old Sphinx head. You ever see that?
Yeah.
They had a Sphinx head where they started, and the Sphinx would light up, and the Kabuki would get sucked up the nose. But that old Sphinx head is still in that warehouse down there. I haven't sold anything, man. There was road cases in the back. The wheels that either went up in them or went into the ground, but they were just sitting flat on the ground. Who knows what's in all this? But I found all these old par cans, just tons of par cans, all wired with brown lamp cord. No ground. Dude, so somebody climbed up in the truss, and it's like you do Christmas tree lights.
Right.
That's how they're all their lighting show. It was brown lamp cord, and like every 20 feet, there was another extension that had to be plugged in.
Oh, mercy.
Awesome as that.
You mentioned their lights earlier. What's the story behind that?
Billy told me about this one. He admitted, he goes, he got it from the Stones. Every light was white. Like back at the time, this was state of the art. Say everybody had 80 lights. These guys had like 20, and they shot them in their mirrors. And the whole idea was creating this crazy thing that was never exactly. He showed me old pictures of it. It was kind of cool.
These bands are crazy, and I know they're known for being jokesters. Do you have any embarrassing stories?
When we were in rehearsals, we rehearsed in Quebec, and there was this guy out shooting everything. And, you know, you just look over, you know how it is, this guy shooting video. I didn't know any of this stuff was going to be used. And I was up mic in the drum kit one day and talking to Tom, and I made some crack about Tom liking long, slim things and all this kind of crap. Well, I didn't realize they were going to take all this video and release it. And they were doing, you know, Nickelback tour prep, episode one, episode two. I didn't know any of this stuff until people started saying, hey, man, I saw you on YouTube. I was like, what? Yeah, you were making some dick joke. And, what?
So, Tony, sir, you guys have anything in the works?
Well, we have a TV show here in town called Jimmy Bowen and Friends.
Oh, yeah.
We do two seasons a year, 12 episodes. Each night we do 3 tapings per night. Anyway, Joe mixes front of house. I'm the broadcast engineer, so I do the recording, and then I take it back to my studio and mix. So it's just great to be able to spend a couple of weeks working with Joe again. You know, we do heritage acts, John Barry, Wade Hayes, Jason Crabb, Rhonda Vincent, Michelle Wright, people like that. But anyway, check it out, Jimmy Bowen Show. Anyway, we're doing it again here in January. We film it, and you know, video will send me a rough cut, and then I'll do the mixing at my studio. So it takes about 3 or 4 months. So the episode that we do in January will come out around June, I believe it will be, of 2024.
That's very cool. So where does the show air?
It airs on several different networks, Heartland, CMT, Circle TV. They always post everything up on YouTube. As a matter of fact, our friends back home in Ohio, we just had McGuffey Lane, which is a very popular band in Ohio, on the show, and their episode is going to air here second week of December.
Very cool. Well, Joe, Tony's been on the show before, and he's had a chance to answer this question, but we do this thing here that we call Unsung Heroes, where we take a moment to shine the light on somebody who works behind the scenes or somebody who may have been supportive to you in your career. Do you have anybody that you'd like to shine a little light on?
Oh, wow. Again, I'm sure there is. Who can I think of? I mean, my family. Well, you know, I can remember my parents. Both of my parents are gone now. I remember, you know, certainly when you get into doing something like this for a living, especially when you're younger, you know, your parents are going, oh, boy. Mine never said it, but I'm sure they were. And I did a Michael Bublé tour in 2000-something, early 2000s or mid-2000s. We were in Columbus, Ohio. My parents came to the show. Once they saw the buses and the, it wasn't a bunch of guys in a station wagon, you know, and the food, it was good, and the venue was good. And it was like, oh, okay, so this is
real.
Okay. And I remember my dad saying, yeah, all right. Okay. I get it. This is cool. But I guess I would have to be, you know, my family was not musical at all. No one did anything like this. It wasn't like any of them. Hey, you know, I didn't have a uncle that was a record producer or anything like that. But I would have to just go back to them never discouraging me and letting me chase after something that I was a parent. I'd be kind of, you know, who wouldn't be a little bit, hey, I'm going to get in the music business. Oh yeah. Okay. Good luck with that. You know, you're going to end up painting stripes on the road or whatever. You get my point.
No, I was right there with you. I mean, I wanted to get into the music business and I found the ad in the back of the magazine like everybody else does. And that's what I wanted to do. And I told my father, I said, look, I was in architectural engineering school at the time. And I was like, look, I want to change over to audio engineering.
That's a bigger jump than any of us made. That's a pretty big jump.
Right. You should have listened to your father.
Yeah. Are you nuts?
I was 2 years into it. And my father said, all right. So how's this work? What are you going to do? And I'm like, well, school starts in like 4 or 5 days. And he's like, all right. And he bought me a plane ticket, shipped me off to Ohio.
See, I mean, a lot of
somebody
people would
picked
do
me
that.
Up at the airport. I don't even know how I got there, but it all came together. A big thanks to Joe and Tony for taking the time to share their stories with us tonight. And thank you for taking the time to hang with me here. I really do appreciate it. Please follow, share, and connect on all the socials. You can do that and find the links to everything mentioned over at jfranzi.com/episode39. Thanks again for listening. And I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Jay Franzi Show. Make sure you visit us at jfranzi.com. Follow, connect, and say hello. This episode has been brought to you by VR Knives, your source for 100% custom knives made by a true rock star. So, if you're in the market for a new piece of art, reach out to VR Knives. 407-421-5528. 407-421-5528.